estate for the Kanaka Maoli or the local people. It's for foreign investors. It's for gentlemen's estate farms that have giant swimming pools. It's for, excuse me, really inappropriate use of one of our most sacred resources. In fact, the name for water in Hawaii is Wai, and the name for wealth in Hawaii is Wai Wai, which means if you have water, you have life. But our water has been taken away from us, and it's left us in this dry, barren, almost unrecognizable, it would be unrecognizable to our ancestors, this condition that we're currently living under, the settler government. So you combine the dispossession with the over-tourism, with the overdevelopment, and you have this trifecta for disaster. And that's what we're seeing today. It's absolute disaster. It's absolute devastation.
Saving everyone.
Thank you. The mutual aid group in Maui has mobilized.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
Tune in to Pathways, a show featuring conversations with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. Join me, host Paul O'Brien, or my co-host Donald Altman every Sunday morning from 8:30 to 9 a.m. You can find out more about the show or listen to the program archive at kboo.fm/pathways.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee will meet twice in August via public video conference. The Finance Committee meeting will be on Thursday, August 10th at 5:30, and again on Thursday, August 24th at 5:30 p.m. A public link and phone number to attend the virtual meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. Good morning. This is The Gap on KBOO Portland. My name is Tammy, and with me is the one and only Althea Billings.
Hello and good morning. Happy to be here.
Super stoked. We're
like sharing a mic.
Yes, you're looking right into my eyes, and I love it.
I'm sorry, I don't know where else to look.
This is fantastic. We are so stoked to be here in the studio today. We have a fantastic interview for those who might be first-time listeners. This is The Gap, where we have a two-part show. We start off with either a news roundhouse kick to the news, yep, or an interview. And then for the second part is where we open up the phone lines for you to call in and answer a community question. And today we are super lucky to be speaking with two key members of the organization, Sisters of the Road. Joining us is their communications and fundraising director, Justice Haygard, and executive director, Kat Mahoney. For decades, Sisters of the Roads has been on the forefront of supporting individuals facing low-income challenges and experiencing houselessness. Their incredible work includes providing meals, ensuring everyone can dine with dignity, and much more. But Sisters isn't just immediate relief. They also commit to seeking systemic solutions that address the root causes of homelessness and poverty with the ultimate aim of ending it. Thank you, Kat and Justice, for joining us into the studio today. How are y'all doing?
Doing all right. How are you?
All is well. How are you, Justice?
Doing pretty good, and thanks for having us here today.
Heck yeah, we're super excited for this interview. We talk about the org a lot and all the news and everything in between, but before we get into that, can you, when we talk about housing and homeless services in Portland, there are many different organizations and groups that make up this landscape. Can you tell us where Sisters fits into this landscape and what services you offer?
Oh, that's me. Okay. Well, in our perfected, like totally operational form, the main thing that we've had since 1979 is our kind of barter work cafe, right? Program. That's one of the main components. And that's where, you know, we don't operate a soup kitchen. We don't just give away food. People actually can come in and they can, if they have money, they can pay for a meal, $1.50. Since 1979, price hasn't changed. Also, we actually went to Congress and worked with Senator Hatfield to pass a law saying people could use EBT to get hot food. So we were the first nonprofit cafe in the country to give hot food for food stamps. And then if neither of those work for you, you can spend 15 minutes working, doing something like bussing tables, greeting people as they come in, all that kind of stuff, refilling people's water in order to earn a meal. And so that's kind of the thing that we're most known for. But on top of that, of course, we've always had our systemic change program as well that's been focused on addressing the root causes of homelessness and poverty in order to end them so we can just be the coolest cafe on the planet and not have to deal with the problems that are bringing people in the door in the first place. So
it's awesome. Thank you so much.
Well, yeah, it is a lot of this like frontline work, and there's so many different pieces of the puzzle in the landscape in Portland. I'm curious, in what kind of ways does Sisters intersect with other service providers? Portland Street Response, for example, has been in the news and talked about a lot lately.
Well, we don't do direct service in that regard, but we do cooperate and collaborate with groups often because it takes every angle and every type of group to address the problems that we have. They're multifaceted, they're complex. Every individual has an individual need. So while our nonprofit cafe seems like a very general, like, oh, we feed people brunch and lunch, we also give people a sense of safety and community, a place to hang out. And then with Portland Street Response, when that formed, we were ecstatic because it was a way that people could get help without having fear of police brutality or even just mismanagement of police who are not trained to help people in crises.
So you're talking about supporting it when it initially started. Have you had experiences with them since then? What's the experience been like?
I had a personal experience with them. Mm-hmm. Last year when, during the snowstorm, I want to say that was probably February or March, mm-hmm. We had all gone home for the day early because it was starting to snow. And I ended up getting a text message from somebody saying, hey, there's somebody over on Northeast Broadway who's in trouble. And she was in the street. She was taking off her clothes. She was just having a crisis. And Portland Street Response was caught up in the snowstorm and traffic, so they were about 45 minutes out. And I live walking distance, so I went over there. And by the time I got there, she had gone into a store, had locked herself in the bathroom, and was like messing around with all the supplies in there. So I waited till she was calm, because we are trained in de-escalation techniques as well. So I waited till some of the noises kind of quieted down. I knocked on the door. I asked if she was okay and if she wanted to come out yet, and she said no. And I said, okay, let me know when you're ready. Waited a little longer. Eventually she came out. She started talking to me. She saw my hat. I had a Sisters of the Road hat on, and I had my leather motorcycle jacket on. And she recognized the logo, which was interesting. But she couldn't remember what we do. But what she really transfixed on was my motorcycle jacket, because she had a motorcycle. She had an ex who had a motorcycle. So we actually talked about motorcycles and riding, and she started to calm down. And when Portland Street Response came in, initially she thought they were police, and she got incredibly anxious that they were going to arrest her. So they reassured her, no, we are not the police. And I reassured her that they are our friends. Trust them. I trust them. And I watched Portland Street Response escort her outside into their van. They gave her socks. They gave her hot chocolate. They talked to her. They asked her her name, you know, and they just talked to her as a human being and not as a problem and not as this sick, broken thing. They treated her with dignity. And it contrasts the times I've watched police interact with somebody in crises where they're yelling orders at them and they eventually allow their canine patrol to enter and they sick the dog on them. So, yes, the organization supports Portland Street Response. I personally support Portland Street Response, and watching them work like that, that's who we need.
And when we talk about the communities that Sisters of the Road services, Portland Street Response and kind of just City Hall, kind of being the worst when it comes to trying to actually help people who are just suffering tremendously, between the camping bans and things like that. So how has your work and the communities that you service been impacted by recent City Hall actions?
Yeah, well, there's... it's not just the recent ones, right? The recent ones are the product of a long history of kind of underinvestment and actual root cause solutions to the problems that Portland is facing, right? And so we're in the situation we're in now where we have like one of the highest rates of unsheltered homelessness in the country, especially for families with children, because we have historically underinvested in the amount of housing available, especially affordable housing, right? And there's like a direct correlation between people living outside and the cost of living going up, not in tune with people's wages. So there's that part. But unfortunately, it's like the money that's being invested now is being invested in, more kind of mass shelter sites, like the temporary alternative shelter site that just recently opened in the Clinton Street Triangle. It's being, hypothetically invested in enforcing this new camping ban, although they say they're not going to enforce it now, but for how long? Mm. And then, it's like... when we had testimony against putting these new camping rules, I really appreciated what Kaya, the executive director of Street Roots, said, which is it's like a sad state of affairs when the best shelter available to somebody is jail. And that's not a situation where we want to end up in. It's also the most expensive form of shelter. So part of the problem is that, the city is constantly investing in keeping up appearances and trying to quell like popular concern about the visibility of homelessness rather than actually trying to address the things that are causing people to be homeless in the first place. And that's, with these latest things, you're seeing that too, but it even goes back to like just the constant sweeps that we've been seeing over the years. It's like you're just pushing people around all the time and spending tons of money doing it, and it doesn't actually change anything. And then, you can watch, I think people are familiar with the site of seeing a camp get swept and then like a week later there's a new camp there. We're just throwing money away doing that kind of thing, as opposed to trying to invest in actually, like, we won't get immediate results, right? You can't solve the root causes tomorrow. But if you make those long-term investments, then one, eventually you're going to be in a better place, but two, the situation's not going to get worse, which is, as long as we're not investing in those long-term solutions, that's what's going to happen, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, if we don't deal with the affordable housing problem, more people are going to end up, experiencing homelessness.
Yeah, they keep throwing money at it, but the solutions are not viable and they're not sustainable.
Well, you mentioned long-term solutions. Can you, for the people, what are we referencing here?
At the end of the day, it's housing. Housing is the solution to homelessness. It's not hard. We try to make it more complicated than we need to. And, do some people need additional help in order to stay stable and stay in housing, like job training or mental health assistance or, drug rehabilitation? Sure. But that's not most people. At the end of the day, most people need either just help getting in the first place, whether that's financial or sometimes just bureaucratic, because it's like not always straightforward or easy to know how to get into housing that is available to people. But then, the financial assistance is really important, especially often at first, because it's like to move from being on the street to being into a place, there's a lot that goes with it. Including like, even if you get that housing, then it's like a lot of things that people don't think about. It's like, okay, now you have no furniture, you have no kitchen equipment. And it's like all that stuff is a part of it too. And just the cost of moving into a place from living on the street, and then the adaptation period before you can maybe stabilize over time. But there's, growing body of research all across the country that says, like, you know, rapid rehousing really works. If mm-hmm. you just put people straight into housing from the street, it's actually, you know, more effective than anything else you could do with that money, in terms of actually solving the housing problem. You know, people, there's a lot of to do that's made, especially in a lot of like reporting and stuff around this, around what about the addiction. But it's like, that's also a separate problem. You know, dealing with addiction is very, very hard. It's like not easy for anyone, and it's not easy for society to deal with it. And, you know, we've had people using drugs and being addicted to drugs in our society for probably as long as there's been such a thing in people's mind as drugs. And so that's not necessarily going anywhere, and it's just, it is what it is. But it's like, what we can do is we can actually solve homelessness. And then, you know, for people who are ready, who are willing and want to move into those kind of treatment programs, who need it, then we make those available to them. And it's also a lot easier for them to succeed. You know, you come out of treatment and you have housing already, then, you know, it just increases the chances that you won't relapse quite a lot, as opposed to you get out of that and now you're in a bureaucratic system that's trying to get you into housing while you stay in a shelter. Not quite as effective.
Yeah, thank you for that. And talking more about what's been happening in the last year, an out-of-town player has entered the scene this year, Urban Alchemy, who lobbied the city to run the open-air mass encampment, and that's being very gentle with the wording. What has your experience been like working with them, as far as they got a lot of pushback for a closed bidding process, for being external to the community on an already controversial project? So what has that been like? I know, Kat, you've had a lot of experience with them.
So when Urban Alchemy was in the running for the bidding process, they actually reached out to a number of groups in Portland area, and we were one of them. And so I met with Kirkpatrick Taylor and Lena Miller, and you know, our stance is housing first. Mm-hmm. Our stance is long-term sustainable real solutions, including living wages, including creating housing that has multiple bedrooms, so that if you do have children or extended family, you're not leaving the Portland metro area because all we have here are studios and one bedrooms mm-hmm. now. Mm-hmm. You know, what happened to that? But so their mission, they say, is to work with folks, have them in these temp shelters, and in theory, be there as ambassadors to help them get towards permanent housing solutions. However, if you look at their track record, or at least if you Google them, you'll find that there's been controversial issues. There's been apparently drug dealing in their camps, some of them from the actual employees themselves dealing to the people there. There's been violence now and then. And then in these camps, it seems to be, since they're up and running and brand new, there's issues in which folks who may have a caseworker or a social worker are having issues trying to contact their clients. And it's very disheartening to find that out. And I, you know, their mission is radically different from ours. And when I met with them, I asked them a number of questions as to how they're going to handle folks in Portland and how every person is. We see them as an individual. That's one of our values. So how are you going to view that? Because that's, you know, we cannot support this unless we understand that your values align with ours. And it turned out that they don't. There are some nonprofits out there that will thrive on suffering. And if I'm going to be very blunt, I feel Urban Alchemy is one of those. Mm. Whereas we're a nonprofit that would love to end suffering and honestly just have a cafe or not even have to exist.
And, you know, I think that for me, one of the things that in terms of what do we think is like part of the problem with the approach of Urban Alchemy is summed up by one of the quotes from the founder, where she said, "We want to be the Google or Instagram of social services." Not the best approach.
Scaling.
Scale fast, move fast, and don't be concerned about the consequences, right? Make it all about growth. That's what you're basically saying, if that's what you want to be. And they want to go national. And so what's happening here in Portland is not happening in a void, too. It's like part of like this trend. I mean, they've been expanding rapidly across the country. Just a few years ago, They had one contract for managing public toilets in mm-hmm. San Francisco, and now they're like, you know, like soon to be probably like $100+ million organization in just like 5 or 6 years. That's the kind of explosive growth. And then with that, it's going to inevitably come consequences because you're not thinking through what you're doing. You're not thinking through how you're expanding. You're not rooting yourself in the communities that you're entering into. And that's, you know, if you want to be effective, that's part of what you have to do, because you have to look at like what the context you're operating in is, right? I mean, that's, I shouldn't have to say that, but nonetheless.
I have a quick follow-up for that is, for lack of better words, it sounds like their business model, and not the humane actually like trying to help people, but the business model seems to be working. Why and how are they able to attain this much success? Like, what is it about their mission and vision that is working for them, not in the way that it should?
I think people fall in love very easily with what sounds like a quick and easy solution. Mm-hmm. And I think Portland generally has an issue with that, where they fall in love very quickly. They're like, oh, this will solve all our issues. We saw it with Portland police saying, oh, we want ShotSpotter. It's going to solve all our issues. We'll know when every bullet is shot. We'll know when every volleyball has popped. We'll know everything. And clearly, really bad idea.
Yeah.
Doesn't talk about the racial disparity. Doesn't talk about where are you putting these things. And now
or that it doesn't work at all.
It doesn't work. Precisely.
Yeah.
You know, I also have a story about Terry Green coming at me in my DMs from ShotSpotter.
All fair.
But with Urban Alchemy, it sounds like it's a done deal. Like, hey, we will run your camps. We will make sure your area is safe. We will enforce these really nice good neighbor agreements. We're going to do all this great stuff. And we will make sure that the folks in the camp get one meal a day and a hefty snack. It's going to be rad. And so Portland says, this is great. This is a wonderful idea. We don't have to run around. We don't have to try and get our other nonprofits to get these resources who don't have enough money to come in. Because Urban Alchemy makes, what, almost $60 million a year or something with all their contracts now?
Mm-hmm.
And it's growing. Like, they are growing at the speed that she wants them, that Lena Miller wants them to grow.
Mm.
So they have the money to come in full staff or full whatever. And so, yeah, it looks like it's a done deal. You know, it's like you could buy a microphone, you could buy a sound station, or you could buy the whole package.
Mm.
And every city's like, oh, my gosh, we don't even have to think. We just buy the whole package.
Oh, right. Good. Jeez.
And then you find out it's not sustainable. It doesn't work. And it actually offers no way out.
Well, that goes to the next question here. How do entities like Urban Alchemy get in the way of housing?
Well, it's like at the end of the day, it's like you're putting all these dollars into this, like, what's a temporary Band-Aid that's not actually going to solve the problem. And you put a Band-Aid on like a wound that is like needs surgery. I mean, you know, that's not going to help that much. So, you know, it's like one thing if you have a little scratch, but we have a lot more than a scratch right now. And so we need to invest that money elsewhere. I mean, that's the ultimate reality. And you know, I think that it's easy to get in this kind of situation where people say, oh, well, the housing's not here now, so what are we going to do today? And I think that sometimes it is hard because you're like, oh, it's not humane to have people living in tents on the street and, you know, except the, you know, I know there's some people who actually that's what they like and that's great for them. They're not the majority of people. They're almost no one. And so we know that this is not a good situation, and we know, you know, that there, that, but it's like, if you don't have that, that end product of where to put someone and the shelter ends up being kind of like long-term housing for people, that, you know, that's not what these things are designed for. That's not how this is like supposed to work. It's like you look at what they've done in Houston, right, where they've really focused on implementing a housing first model, and they were able to do so with COVID relief funds and be very effective. And then they put somebody in a shelter, but they're there for like 2 or 3 weeks, and then they're mm-hmm. transitioned into housing.
Mm-hmm.
And they're focusing all their dollars on creating that pipeline and making sure that when they go to some encampment and say an outreach worker goes there, they say, hey, we can get you into housing in a few weeks. Are you interested? 90% of the people say yes. And their success rate has been enormously, I mean, it's like, it's amazing model for us all to be looking towards, because there you can look and they'll say, not just a year later, but 2 years later, they're still having 80, 90% of people staying in housing. So it's working. Mm-hmm. And it's like, they don't do sweeps in Houston, at all. They don't have to, because people willingly come with the outreach workers and go to their temporary shelters because they know that there's a pathway for them. And so, like, if we don't create that pathway, then what are we doing? Just creating more and more and more of these like places for people to be homeless. I mean, this is like, I often find myself quoting Marcia Fudge, who's the head of Housing and Urban Development in the Biden administration. It's like, we don't need to create more places for people to be homeless. You're just throwing money away. I mean, effectively, when you're saying, okay, you can have your tent here, we're gonna spend, you know, $8 million to have your tent here or to have you in a pod here, and then you're going to be there till what? Till you get frustrated with the rules there and you decide that this isn't really working for you. A big thing I meant to mention it earlier is like with the Urban Alchemy sites, and with a lot of shelters, you can't have visitors. It's like cutting people off from community is the worst thing you can do. Mm. People need that. So, you know, this is part of the reason that people don't want to go to the shelters, is because it's fine to deal with that for a little while. But after a while, you're just like, I would rather be in my tent and be able to live my life the way that works for me, as opposed to having to, like, you know, have this kind of paternalistic figure who's telling me, you can't have visitors, you have to be here by this time. I mean, also, I could go on and on. Like, there's a whole other thing about people who work at night. Like, you know, if the shelter, you can't enter the shelter past a certain point, and like, it's after you get off work and you have a job and you're homeless. Mm. Well, too bad. I guess you're going to have to live on the street. So this is part of the thing, is it's like, these are one size fit all solutions. We're just going to put people en masse into these places. And we're just going to keep them there with no plan of how they're going to get out. And you know, that's the kind of situation that's being implemented. That's not going to work. It's like, unless you have the downstream part of it figured out, then like, just creating these shelter sites is just like, okay, it's just a place to kind of corner people off to get them out of sight at the end of the day. And it's not, we don't want people to be living in tents. I mean, we want people to have access to meals, sanitation, all of that stuff. But it's really just a question of, where are we investing the money? And especially when we know that there's money and money and money and money is being poured in, but being poured in to, you know, not necessarily the right things in many cases, and not in a coordinated way, which is another part of it.
Well, and one of the other things is that these temporary shelters and sweeps and everything that we've seen, I mean, for decades, there's been some sort of sheltering system for folks who don't have homes. Mm-hmm. But at this moment in time, more than anything, just because it's so numerous, these things are made to hide people. Mm. They're not actually made to help people. And sheltering and sweeps are for housed people, in a sense, where you no longer have to walk by that tent. You no longer have to see this person who maybe is arguing with their partner, and they don't have four walls and a door. So the things you do behind your closed door, you're seeing on the street. Well, if you don't like that, then advocate for housing. Get them back in a house. Get them help. Talk about how jobs need to have living wages. Talk about the notion of rent control, rent stabilization, some sort of program. You know, make sure there is some sort of long-term solution. So these temporary alternative shelters, these affinity villages, the people who use them and benefit from them, it's wonderful. But the reality is, it's to hide the problem from housed folks.
Yeah, I mean, it's and to some extent, I get it. And I don't even want to feel like negative towards people for feeling that way, because it's painful to watch people suffering and to see it so visibly all around you every day. It takes a toll on your soul in a certain way. And then it's way easier to blame those people, as it's like a moral failure. It's a personal failure. They messed up. They started using drugs. They refused to like pick their life up. That's so much easier to buy into than the idea that we failed them as a society, and that I might have some, you know, measure of blame for being a part of that. And that's, I think that's the reality, is that, that is hard for people. And I think that when you offer this out and say, no, they're not ready for housing. We need to put them through this program first. They need to go to the site and clean up, or like whatever it is, that people are very willing to believe that, because it in a way absolves them from responsibility.
And if it's a moral failing, it's not necessarily a moral failing of the individual. It's a moral failing of our government.
Mm-hmm.
For sure.
On all levels, really. But
Well, you just kind of mentioned some of it, but the narratives and also, yes, people in houses do drugs all the time. You know, like yeah. That's not, and they fight and they do all these things. This is just humans, you know?
Yeah.
And you talked about a little bit in the work that you do with Sisters of the Road, what kind of misconceptions, myths, or narratives do you encounter that are just not true or incorrect?
Oh, we sometimes get emails from folks who tell us that homeless people are drug addicts, so they should just get treatment first before they get any sort of housing, or why do they deserve housing where I have to have a job and get housing? And it's like, look, not every houseless person is doing drugs. Let's be honest. There are plenty of people who are housed who are doing drugs, like you just said. Mm-hmm. And if you are out and about in Chinatown where we are and you see things happening usually around evening time, you will see it is housed people who will drive up onto our street or in our blocks around us.
In big SUVs.
In big, gigantic Escalades, like it's something out of like an FBI TV show, like Mad Money. And they will come out and start dealing to unhoused people. And you know, when you talk to people and entities that could actually do something about this, we have been told, oh, well, the police don't go to Sisters of the Road. So they won't go, they won't patrol the block. I mean, that's one of the myths we've tried to combat, where it's like, look, not every house person is, but however, if somebody is going to indulge in something, there is a sense of empathy and understanding where it's like, if every day you're on heightened awareness as somebody could slash my tent, somebody could hurt me. If you're female, the fears are tenfold, especially female at night alone. Well, maybe you do want to do and take something. Maybe you want to drink something. Maybe you want to do to just not think for a couple of hours. How many of us use Netflix as escapism? If you don't have Netflix, maybe you are going to smoke something. That doesn't make you a bad person.
No. Well, and it's not just that, right? Like, it's like also people do it as survival mechanism. Like, we know that people, like, they actually take amphetamines so they can stay up at night because it's not too safe to sleep. And then sometimes when people do that, they can't come down, they can't go to sleep. So then they start, you know, using something to try to help them sleep during the day. And it's like, that's like one of the ways that, like, it doesn't, it's like, I think that the important thing around the drug use part of it is to understand that it's like, it's not like a lifestyle choice. It's not like, that's like not, I think that that's a, or, and it's not, it's usually not always, I mean, it varies, but it's not usually necessarily that people become homeless because they're using drugs and their life falls apart. It's like they become homeless and then they start using drugs, right? Like, so that's often the way that it goes too. So, I mean, again, just like, it's not this moral failing, but, I mean, the other, some of the, there's a lot of different things that are misconceptions, but I think that the drug thing is a big one. The mental health thing is also a big one. It's like, of course, like a lot of people are like depressed and freaking out when they live outside. I mean, like, it would be hard not to be depressed by what you have to face every day. And in fact, that's one of the things that, you know, is one of the biggest struggles for people, is just being like, having any sense of self-worth or belief that they deserve anything better than what they have. That's actually a huge issue. As one,
we've also been told that it's easy to be homeless in Portland.
Oh, yeah. Because there's so many services. Right. It's so easy. you know, it's like, you know, it's, you have to be operating from a position of complete, like, not understanding of what people's lives are like to, like, believe something like that. But, I mean, I think people do. They think, oh, we have all these services. It just enables people to be like, it's great. I get to live outside and do whatever I want and do drugs, and it's so cool. And it's like, that's not, that's, like, not the reality, right? And that's another thing, is the whole magnet myth. So this is, like, an ongoing thing. It always exists, that there are just magnet cities that just attract people coming from all over because they heard it's so great here. And then especially with Measure 110, that's really been a narrative that we've heard from a lot of people, is that, oh, they're just coming here because we made it easy for people to live outside and do drugs. And it's like, the reality is, you look at any of the data that's available, it'll always tell you most people who are experiencing homelessness are very close to where they last lived. And it's like, one, it's like, it's it's kind of like, what is this idea that people think that when you're living outside and you have no resources that you can just move wherever you want? One, but also people like to stay connected to family, to friends, to familiar places, to community. They want to stay, you know, close to those connections that they have to their former life when they end up on the street. So there's no magnet. We could go on and on and on, but I mean, I think that those are some of the biggest ones. Is just, and then also just understanding that it's not like people are refusing services. In many cases, the reason people are refusing services if they are is because they don't believe that anything will happen as a result. And they like don't believe, like, if I go with you to the shelter, I'm just going to be in that shelter for indefinitely, because there's no actually place for me to go after that.
And that's true in many ways.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is the thing about that pipeline again. It's like, if you don't have a sense of belief or trust from people, that you're going to offer something that is actually going to make their life better, then why are they going to listen to you, or why are they going to take some kind of referral from you? They're not. They're going to go, you know, that's not going to go anywhere. That's a waste of time.
For sure.
And move on. Yeah. And the sweeps don't help, because then it's like, how are you going to trust some person who's coming from the city that they're going to have anything useful to say to you, when every time that somebody has come before, it's to like post a notice that they're going to destroy your stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this is part of the whole shebang, is that it's like, you know, this is the reality that people deal with. It's like, it's incredibly hard to live outside for all the reasons. It's dangerous. You know, even just, it's like people have described it as a full-time job for just sure. to get fed every day.
Yeah.
And much less navigate some of any, if you are trying to get on a wait list into housing or something like that, it's like then you have to run across the city to go out to all these appointments, and meanwhile you're leaving your tent and everything that belongs to you just sitting somewhere unguarded. Hopefully nobody messes with it, but then maybe you come back and it's been destroyed. You know, I mean, this is like the reality that people live with, and then you have nothing and you have to start over again. That's not even getting into things like, what if you lose your ID?
Right.
How are you going to prove your identity if you did want to get a job, or you do want to go into one of these programs? And then when you don't have an address, like you don't have a birth certificate, you don't have any identifying documents. So it's just like, one of the things that I think it's just so important is to understand how incredibly hard it is, and how difficult it is, and then imagine that. And then try to like view people's behavior through that lens,
right,
rather than through the lens of like, you know, like your position kind of often maybe sitting comfortably in, I'm not saying you, but saying one's position where you maybe have a house, have a job, and have a relatively measure of stability in your life.
Right. Changes the perspective. Well, I want to pivot us here a little bit,
okay,
because Sisters of the Road purchased a new building very recently, and you're in the process of reopening the cafe. What can you tell us about that process?
it was an adventure, I'll tell you that.
Nice.
It was a giant leap of faith.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were at a crossroads last fall. Like, what are we going to do? We can't necessarily reopen in the space we're in. Every time we thought about fixing something, we found three or four more problems.
Sure.
You know, it's like you open a wall and all of a sudden, oh, surprise. So we made a decision that we were going to buy a building finally and not be under a leasehold, you know, where we can't make repairs timely, or we can't get certain things done because the building has whatever else going on. So we hunted around, and it's funny because I had said, oh man, I want the House of Louis. And then I looked around and it turned out it was for sale. And a couple of months later, started a due diligence period. And like, you know, this idea took off sometime in mid-September. And then by February, I was in escrow. And then by the end of May, we signed for it. So,
nice.
Yeah, it's three times the size of what we have, basically. We're going to be able to put our administrative office and our cafe together under one roof finally. So the whole team is together, because we've been in two different buildings. Mm-hmm. And it makes it really hard for everyone to come together and meet, because one of our values is that we all talk to each other too and have good relationships. And when you're in two separate buildings, you don't have that all the time. So ideally, there'll be more seating. There'll be more meals served every day. There'll be a community room specific outside of the cafe space, so the cafe can stay open and people could say, hey, can I use this room for an hour? And you can. And when that room's not in use, people can go in there and relax. it's going to ideally encapsulate all the vibes and heart that the cafe always had, but be in a bigger, cleaner space.
And where are you at in the reopening process? I mean, obviously you just signed for it pretty recently.
Yeah, we're probably about 2 years out. We started demolition. That's almost done. Next phase will be to upgrade electrical, plumbing, repair the roof. Some other things have to get cleaned up. And then when all that is done, we'll start doing build out and we'll have a campaign for all of that. And right now we have a summer campaign going on.
Well, yeah, to that, if our listeners are interested in learning more about Sisters of the Road, about what you do, or want to support your work, what's the best way for them to do that?
They could go to our website, sistersoftheroad.org, and they can see some of our latest and greatest escapades that we've been up to. They can check our Instagram account, which is also linked on our first page. There's a donate button up at the top right-hand corner. They can, and from our website, they could subscribe to our email newsletter. And that's probably the best way to keep up on everything. That's a good central hub to figure out what social media platform works best for you.
Mm-hmm. And also, I will just briefly mention, we actually just opened 3 positions. So we're actually hiring for our systemic change team and for our communications and fundraising team right now. So if people are looking for a job, consider us. But also, if you're not and you know people who are, definitely send them our way, because we're looking for some people to expand our team. But yeah, definitely donations are great. We're a community funded organization, so that's where almost all our money comes from. We, you know, made a decision in the beginning that we would not really pursue government contracts as a source of funding in order to stay independent of all the things that come with that. So we rely on the community.
Well, thank you so much. This has been incredible hearing from y'all. We're over here with Kat Mahoney and with Justice Haygard from Sisters of the Road. Thank you so much. We're going to go on a quick musical break, and we'll be back in a couple of moments.
All right.
Thank you. Stay tuned to The Gap.
We are back here on The Gap on KBOO Portland, a little bit of the Kennedys with Sisters of the Road.
Love it.
That was great. I really enjoyed that, that interview.
Such a good interview. I'm just sort of basking in it. I feel like we should do a reset. This is The Gap on KBOO Portland. I'm Althea. Tammy's here with me. We're moving into our second part of the show. This is our community question segment, when people can call in and chat to us about what we're talking about today, which is term limits.
Yes, I'll set it up, and people can go ahead and start calling in 503-231-8187. I've been noticing that there's a lot of conversations about politicians, elderly politicians who are older, and them having kind of a hard time, you know, navigating. Mitch McConnell seemed to have a bit of like a not malfunction, but
it suspected that he had a stroke.
It seemed like it, yeah. As he was speaking, and there's Dianne Feinstein, and it's bringing the conversation of term limits. But I think that that we can have this conversation a lot more respectfully, considering that a couple of days later, Mitch McConnell went up in front of people and they were just yelling at him, retire, retire, retire. And I get it. And, you know, there, I understand. And I'm not by any mean like a Mitch McConnell stan. And also, this dude just maybe had a heart, like, you know, a stroke. And like, dude, don't yell at elderly people like that, you know, like, especially when you've just recently seen them, like, you know, have maybe possibly a stroke. And also, political power hoarding, terrible, you know, anti-women, anti-LGBTQ. Yeah. Like, I get
this
it.
This isn't Tammy's coming out as a Mitch McConnell supporter.
Definitely not. So I'm wondering for the listeners, how can we have a respectful conversation about term limits and political power hoarding? Because we also see it in business. It's not just in government, you know? Yeah. And I'm just wondering what folks think. 503-231-8187. And again, I get it. He's done horrible things, and people have the right to feel how they feel. And also, what do we, as I was talking to a friend, and my Selena, and she said, yeah, you know,
hi, Selena.
It's terrible, but you're going to get more bees with honey than vinegar. Because this conversation needs to be had, for sure.
Right.
And who are we alienating when we talk the way that we do?
Right, yeah. 503-231-8187 if you want to chat to us about this. I mean, the thing that comes up for me is I'm not necessarily convinced that term limits are the solution to this kind of issue. What I think about, though, is, like, how do we create a system in which, like, what are the factors that lead them not to retire? Is it, like, not trusting younger generations? Mm. Is it, you know, the way that you know, dark money only wants to fund these one. Lobbyists have connections to this one person. Mm-hmm. Districts are gerrymandered in such a way that this person can get elected again and again and again. Mm-hmm. You know, what are those factors that lead to it being this one person? And is it an issue of, like, distrust of younger people? Is there not, you know, enough connections between generations or things like that? Can we address those things so that it could be, you know, you're allowed to retire, you know? And I think that it also reminds me of, like, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and how people were, you know, when she died, it's like, she wrote so many important decisions, right? But also that she could have retired under Obama and there would have been a liberal justice appointed to her spot. And so, you know, it's like, how could you do that to us, Ruth Bader Ginsburg? What is it about our, like, political system that continues to reinforce the idea that it all falls on one person?
That's a lot of pressure on one person.
Yeah.
That's too much. And I don't like it. But I think that in order to get to those conversations, I think to just yell at people, and I mean, and again, specifically elderly people, I think.
Well, what if they're hard of hearing? Sorry, that's a bad joke. I apologize.
But now instead of having a conversation exactly on the things that you're talking about, like, what's breeding this situation and this environment where people are not retiring at 60 or 70 or 80, you know? Right. But I think that
from the halls of government.
Yeah, specifically. Yeah. And business, you know, and philanthropy, you know, at the end of the day, this is, there's going to be an upcoming shift and it's happening in some industries.
Yeah.
And we expire, you know, we don't live forever. But there's still next generation. So how do, you know, like, how, and if you can't be president at, you know, 25 or 27, then why can't you be president at 98, you know?
Right. There's this idea of, like, paying your dues and waiting your turn.
Sure.
But, like, should your turn come up when you're 85? Like, that? No. Sorry. I hope your turn comes up sooner than that, you know, to be president or whatever.
I'd be happy with a council of elders.
Yeah, I think that'd be very
useful.
There's merit to that. Folks, if you want to chime in on the conversation, please, 503-231-8187 is the number. You can chat with us. 503-231-8187. Yes, you can message us on Instagram, also at The Gap Radio, if you would so enjoy. And I can pull up the lurk here, too. I don't know. People haven't been vibing that one, but it's okay. well, one of the things that you and I were talking about as a part of this is, like, this idea of respecting your elders, mm-hmm. right? And I think that that's said enough that we agree with it.
Mm.
But do we practice it on both sides of things?
Mm.
You know, do we practice that? Well, sure, we'll respect our elders when they're,
you know, people in government, but do we respect the elders that are around us? Mm. You know, is aging with dignity a thing, right, you know, in the rest of society? And it's like kind of less so, I think.
I do, going back to what you're saying about the environment, like Ruth Bader Jr. Oh my God.
Ruth Bader. The second coming of Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Well, there could have been a Ruth Bader. There could have been a Jr.
I mean, we don't know.
There could have been. What do you think that makes people feel like they can't let go? Because it's the same with Dianne Feinstein, right? Because there was a time where if she would have exited, there would have still been another Democrat, you know, there, it would have been a Democrat in there.
Yeah.
And why, like, in your opinion, like, personal opinion?
Why do I think? I guess I don't know a ton about, like, the conditions of her district or whatever, but I mean, I think that...
Well, generally speaking.
Well, one of the things that we know is that, like, our political system creates an incentive structure, which is stay in office, you know, and especially if you're in, you know, the House of Reps, it's every 2 years. You're hustling all the time. You win one campaign and you start your next one, you know, and there's, you know, costs and benefits to that, but that the structure incentivizes you to stay there, you know, and do whatever you can to stay there. And because that's where everything comes. So I don't know. I mean, I think that that structure exists, but I would love to see, you know, some changes made or an attitude shift or whatever it is to have people not have to hold on in that way.
Yeah.
And I understand we have Brad on the line. Brad, how you doing?
Fine. How are you?
Good, good. What do you think about all this?
Well, actually, I said one thing in part, and I didn't hear everything. Maybe you addressed it, but you asked a question about what you thought was the way to stop this retirement, you know, an old age. I think the thought ought to be conjectured that everything in this country is based on capitalism. Your whole life, even your motivation for working. So when you give that up, you're really in an echo land. Yeah. Anyway, what I speak, I think. Correct?
Oh, thank you so much. He makes a great point. Yeah. It's all about the machine of feeding the machine of capitalism, and it means that every pawn has to play game, you know?
Right.
And it does make it, and then I think of, you know, you're just saying of elders in our lives, you know, like, you know, I just think of how many people get thrown away after they don't produce money, or they can't, you know, contribute to society again on purely just how much money can you make, you know?
Generate? How much, or, you know, if you're... politician, how much can you move around to unobscure the transfer of capital, right?
We have April on the line. April, how are you?
Hi, I'm pretty good. How are you two?
All good. Thank you.
Good. Good. I really like your format of asking a question in the second half of the show, by the way. But as far as term limits, I don't necessarily think there should be an age limit on it, but I think that all politicians, including Supreme Court justices, because they are, should be limited in how long they can serve, just so that, you know, you personally could make your decision. Am I ready at 25? Is this the most powerful time in my life when I want to do this? Or am I ready at 60 or 70? But just know that it's not going to be a career. You're not going to do it for more than a certain amount of time. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, what happens for everyone, and this is how we get new ideas in there. It doesn't have to be a generational thing. It doesn't have to be competitive like most things are under capitalism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I love the idea of a council of elders.
I really do.
Thank you. Yeah, I just, you know, if we don't know our history, we're bound to make the same mistakes over and over again.
I have been an activist most of my life, and I'm now like 61. And when I was like 50, I was still going to protests all the time, right? And I would talk to younger activists, and like, they didn't know maybe what had even happened 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I also noticed, like, starting right at 50, I started being marginalized. You know, I got different types of advertising. I, you know, there's just this, like, you're kind of told that this is your place in society. These are the things you need to choose between. You know, this is the age range you are now. This is what's available. Hmm. And it's like, I reject that, but still I feel marginalized in society.
For sure.
Yeah.
I would say that, you know, unfortunately, in many ways, that's a valid reason because it's true.
Yeah,
it is. It is. But it's amazing to see the difference. But I definitely think there should be limits for all politicians, and that individuals should, I mean, maybe, you know, they if they have insight into, you know, what part of their life is the most valuable to share.
Right.
You know, but maybe they need to be a little more intentional about that, just knowing that there are going to be limits.
Mm-hmm.
And this isn't going to be a lifelong thing.
Yeah. Lifelong careers. Well, thank you, April, for calling. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Have a good one.
You too, bye-bye.
I agree with April. I'm not a big fan of the phrase career politician. It sounds like an oxymoron to me. It's like, you're going to... What incentive do you have to change anything if this is... If your job...
Right, yeah, that's yeah.
How do you say, let the cat watch over the puddle of cream? You've heard that one?
I think I know what you're referencing. Yeah. I'm struggling to find the idiom myself, but I know what you mean.
It's like letting letting
a cat legislate the mice? No.
Yeah, exactly. Know. What's a cat's going to eat the mice?
One thing we're going to do on The Gap is get caught up in a metaphor that we can't quite remember.
As we're wrapping up, we have about 5 minutes left to the show.
There is still time to call if you want. 503-231-8187. Talking term limits.
As people call in, since April was just on, I wanted
this
to
is the segment we do specially for April.
Yeah, this is especially for you.
Not just kidding. We do it for everybody.
It's for it was inspired by April
it
though.
Was inspired by it. Yes, April.
Give
ass.
Credit where credit is due.
Yes.
And there is some awesome things happening this weekend that are open to the public. You like
free,
that?
Yes. Go ahead.
Oh yeah. Just go ahead. Go for it.
I'm doing a bit now. You can say your thing. Sorry.
I see here that you put the Washington Park Summer Fest. That's happening in Washington Park.
I interviewed the organizer last week for the newscast. Tune into the Cable Evening News 5 to 6 weekdays. But yes, Friday, Saturday, Sunday this week is Washington Park Summer Fest. It starts at 6. Very fun things that they have going on there. It's all going to be free. The first night is dancing. There's like dance performances. There's a dance class you can take if you want to. Saturday is the Portland Cello Project doing a tribute to Prince.
Ooh.
At the amphitheater in Washington Park. And then on Sunday is opera in the park.
Ooh.
Many of us have not perhaps had the chance to see an opera, and you can do it for free at Washington Park Summerfest. And there's also, you know, quite a bit of food vendors and stuff like that to check out as well. Washington Park Summerfest.
And speaking of opera, Othello is going to be at the park tonight at Mount Tabor Amphitheater.
Okay.
Man, that is so cool. That's so cool that that's happening. Free to the public.
It's Shakespeare in the Park.
Today, I think it's going to start, it's at 6 p.m.
6 maybe?
6 p.m.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, it doesn't say. It's, 6 p.m., I'm assuming. And then there's also a meteor shower watch.
What?
Happening at Rooster Rock only. OMSI is hosting a meteor shower watch on Rooster Rock on the 12th. That's tomorrow.
Okay.
Very
cool.
That's so exciting. I guess you can probably see it from anywhere. I'll assume it starts once it gets dark.
Daytime meteor showers only at OMSI.
And the Rocky Horror Picture Show is back at the Clinton Street Theater.
Presumably that one may have a fee to enter. But
it may have a fee to enter indeed.
It probably does.
And it might range between 10 to 11, to 12 bucks. And starts at 11 o'clock p.m.
Okay.
Yeah,
nice.
Yeah. This has been a really great and insightful community-oriented program here for the folks.
Yeah. We'll have to come up with a snappy name for what to call it. Oh, we could have come up with a soundbite.
Oh.
Real fans remember TikTok Watch. Anyway, those are the weekend happenings. We are coming to the end of our time. Do you have any final thoughts about term limits, things like that?
I'm just thinking of Rudy Giuliani, and I just think like
into the Giuliani of it all.
That was my grandpa, right? And my grandpa's done horrible things.
You flip-flop on this.
But it's the fact that it's
Saw the indictment.
It hurt me to watch someone like that. It just made me feel like, where's your family, man? Like, why is no one holding you and like telling you, hey, you know, gramps, uncle, something, like,
give it up.
Thea.
You saw what he said about Matt Damon. Sorry, I'm not even like a big Matt Damon fan. Mostly it's just funny to ride for Matt Damon, but only when it comes to Rudy Giuliani.
I just think that we can get to the actual root of the issues if we aren't mean to each other, you know?
Yes.
That's where I get to it.
I have one last thought about term limits, which is that when it's been studied, you tend to have an erosion of institutional knowledge.
Sure.
As in, I believe, the Kansas legislature.
That's why you gotta have the Elder Council of Elders. That's what I think.
Well, we are coming to the end of our time here on The Gap. If you have thoughts to share with us, you can do that at The Gap Radio on Instagram. You can email us, thegapradio@gmail.com. Find this episode, if you missed any part of it, kbu.fm/thegap. It'll be on there in like an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And we're so glad to have had folks from Sisters of the Road, Justice and Kat, with us earlier.
Yeah. Thank you so much, y'all. Have a great weekend.
Thank you to our engineer, Sherry.
Thank you, Sherry.
I'm Althea.
I'm Tammy. Bye.
We'll see you next time. Bye.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience. KBOO, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is now on Venmo. Follow us and send a donation anytime at KBOO Radio. That's at KBOO Radio. Thanks.
Tune in to Talking Earth, a show dedicated to showcasing our local poetry scene. Join hosts Patrick Picard, Barbara LaMorticella, and Walt Curtis for Talking Earth on the second and third Mondays of each month from 10 to 11 p.m. More information can be found on kboo.fm under schedule.
Connect with your favorite community radio station on social media.
Our Facebook page is facebook.com/kboomradio.
And follow us on Twitter.